Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is November 29th, 2016. These are troubled times, and people know this deep down. At Peak Prosperity, we say that these times and how you fare through them will be defined by three things: what you do, what you know, and how you are. Those are your actions, your wisdom, and the way in which you inhabit your life. And it's that last part that's slipperiest for most people, the being of it all. It raises the age-old question, how should I be? Now, this is no small question. It's always part of the human condition, but perhaps never more so than in a time like the present, where one's main cultural narratives seem to be falling apart. Our main narrative of endless, exponential economic growth on a finite planet is not simply senseless, but quite possibly insane. At the very least, it's crazy-making, because we all know deep down on some level that we are a part of, not a part from, nature. And yet we're all participants on this spaceship Earth, and for the most part, neither the crew nor the majority of the passengers seem to be even slightly aware of the major predicaments we face. Why is that? How has it come to be that we find ourselves in this particular condition? More personally, how many of you listening know that you are stuck between two lives, the one you're actually living and the one you feel like you should be living instead? You know, the one that would align your authentic inner gifts with the present realities in a more meaningful and fulfilling way. Now, these are profoundly philosophical questions, and I am really pleased to be able to introduce today Stephen Jenkinson, who I had the deep honor of sitting with for a weekend workshop at Roe just a few weeks ago. Stephen teaches internationally and is the creator and principal instructor of the Orphan Wisdom School, founded in 2010, with master's degrees from Harvard University in theology and the University of Toronto in social work. He is revolutionizing grief and dying in North America. Stephen is redefining what it means to live and therefore die well. Apprentice to a master storyteller, he has worked extensively with dying people and their families. Is former program director in a major Canadian hospital, former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school, and consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations. He's also a sculptor, a traditional canoe builder, and whose self-built house won a Governor General's Award for architecture. He's also a prolific author of books such as Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, and the subject of the weekend workshop at Roe, Money and the Soul's Desires, A Meditation. He has many other fine books, and I will encourage everyone to obtain them and read them. Stephen Jenkinson is also the subject of the feature-length documentary film Grief Walker, a lyrical, poetic portrait of his work with dying people, which had a very large impact on me, as well as the dozens of people I have recommended or given it to. With that, Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. A generous introduction. We'll see if I resemble it in any way at all.
Well, let's dive right in. You know, you have many beautiful interviews out there on your immense and thoughtful work in what you've called the death trade. And it's not my intent here to recreate those interviews, but perhaps to call upon those learnings when and how they seem appropriate. Instead, I seek your wisdom as a careful student of history to see what insights we might draw from the past to help us make sense of our times. Is that something you'd be willing to do?
Let's give it a whirl.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. So let's start here. I'd like to get your reflections on a quote of yours, followed by this question, as I think this will get us started in what I hope is the right direction. Here's the quote: having a conscience now is a grief-soaked proposition. That's the quote. And my question is this. You used the word now in there. Historically speaking, is having a conscience always been a grief-soaked proposition, or is there something about being alive now that is perhaps more troubling to the conscientious than times past?
Yeah, that's a well-wrought question. Well, first of all, I'm not that old, so I don't have, you know, centuries to draw from of having been in the trench. And, you know, the truth is that most people's ordinary lives are the first casualties of any history that's written and conjectured and traded back and forth, and of course taught in school under us. So, you know, it's a bit of a guess as to how people might have experienced the grind, if it was a grind. I'll never forget. You've heard of the playwright Bertolt Brecht. Mm-hmm. He wrote a play called The Life of Galileo, and in there, Galileo is by this time under church arrest too, for that matter, for having taught the way it was, what he could see through his tube. And one of the inquisitors comes to him, and in a collegial fashion, he talks to him about, you know, why he's being banished from promulgating what he's seen through his telescope. And he gestures through the window, and you can see there are peasants in the fields out there working away. And he says to Galileo, you know, if you tell these people that they're not at the crown of creation, they're not at the center of the universe, they're not around which the plan unfurls and uncoils, and they're not the reason, but they're on a bit of rock flying about and so on and so on, how do you expect them to attend to the labor you see them doing right now? It's a powerful thing to wonder about. I mean, it's a bit self-serving, obviously, from the Inquisitor's point of view, but the reason I mention the story is to say how people might have understood what constitutes the world or their place in it in days gone by, I think is really elusive to us. So it's really proper that we not generalize from our predicaments, our lack of them, our mania for being out from under them as quickly and as blithely as possible. With all of that in place, then let me see if I can do justice to the question that you asked. to become awake, maybe that's another good word for conscience. Mm-hmm. To deeply awaken. To, I don't know if there's another kind. Frankly, that might be redundant to say that. But to awaken is a very costly enterprise. How do you know this? I think you know it this way. If awakening were all it was cracked up to be, people would be doing it all the time, wouldn't they? And there would be no reason for this ever to lapse, that you would be permanently and fixedly awake if it were such a compelling proposition as the purveyors of awakeness would have it be for us all. So then you realize, man, there's something in the architecture that mitigates against awakening. And I'm not saying conspiracy-wise, I'm saying architecture. Mm-hmm. In other words, there might be something in the confluence of being a human being or trying to be or trying to imagine that there is such a thing on the one side, and doing so in the context of a living world whose livingness may or may not depend on our presence on the scene. But if we are present, its livingness may very well depend on our capacity to be human, by which I'm suggesting to you that it may be that being human is not a lifestyle option for human beings. It might be the most mandatory proposition going, and not for our sake. That's the big one. That it might be in the nature of being a human being that your humanness is something you take on for the sake of that which sustains you, meaning the living world. If you put all of that in, and then we revisit the question a second time, then, you know, a little etymology is pretty useful right now. To awake, okay, the A prefix sometimes functions the same way the O prefix does in English language. For example, for o'clock, it means of the clock, pertaining to the clock. And awake would mean in the manner of wake, and we know wake both as a noun in its several contortions, means more than one thing. It means the trail, the ebb of consequence, as you plow through, your allotment in years or in place or in relationships, as you plow through those allotments, whatever fans out behind you is properly understood to be a wake. And of course, the other version of wake is those who attend your demise and tell stories about you, some of which may be true, but are probably fashioned to be user-friendly in a troubled time, which is to say it's a deeply unreliable version of you that normally appears at your wake, and by which it would be very challenging for other people to plot a course based on a very selective version of yours, you see. So I know this is more than you asked for, probably, but maybe the gist of it could be something like this. My MO these days is that humanity is an allegation, not a description. It's a rumor, and in some respects, it's a cruel rumor, because it is such a fugitive and a phantom so often. Then awakening is principally awakening to how fugitive one's humanity really is and how possible it is to so deeply betray it, even though it would appear to be something which is, quote, ours. But I'm suggesting it probably isn't ours. Even our own humanity is entrusted to us, not as a personal possession, but in some kind of, in the way that perhaps domestic animals on a farm are entrusted to you, that establishes a kind of covenantal way of proceeding, the two of you together. And maybe your humanity is something similar, that it asks much more of you than it would appear to give you. If you awaken to that, and that's just the personal experience level, I don't know how the tone of your awakening could be anything other than a sob, frankly, and that a sob might be the operatic sound that awakening really calls for. Then imagine that you're awakening in a time and a place which, as you said in your introduction, is so palpably troubled and troubling that it's almost a compound fracture to awaken in such a time, and to actually make the case that your awakeness is more necessary now, when there's much less of a payday for it, than it might have been when the stakes weren't so grim or so high. How to make such a case? How to go from city to city or interview to interview and pitch this idea as somehow good for you? But I'm not sure it is good for you as much as it might enable you towards a kind of goodness that is so counterintuitive that it asks the world of us, maybe.
That's very well said, and it's getting to the heart of what I want to get to. You said there's something in the architecture maybe that prevents this awakening process, and that architecture is culture, which is the theme I really want to weave through here, because this is ultimately what I and everybody is up against in this story, is the culture. And so knowing that that's a thorny thing that will weave its brambly way through this conversation, I'll just sit that aside for a minute and return to this idea that you just raised, which is that we have two levels of awakening we maybe can come to. One is our own personal awakening. That's probably always been part of the human condition, if I could sort of conjecture and hypothesize. And that's part of the humanness of being human. And today there's a special condition, which is we're at a really special moment of human history, not U.S. history, not Canadian, not Indian, but human, where we've hit the edges of our earth. We can feel that. We are still connected to nature in some way. Those webs of connection are breaking. Some people can feel them. They feel them acutely. But that's the second level of awakening, with the vast troves of information we have access to now. We can actually, if we choose, to consciously look at this data and see what it says. And it says something like this to me, and I would love to get your reflection on this. When I just look at, say, the ecological data, it overwhelmingly is pointing to me, to what I read as an unsuccessful conclusion to the human experiment, unless, to use that word from one of my favorite Dr. Seuss books, The Lorax, unless, we do things differently. Is this, do you think, an unfair or overly cynical way to be approaching the world at this time?
That, give me the first part of what you say again, sorry.
That when just adding up the ecological data that we have, say it be global warming or species loss, or the fact that of the insects we do track, bees and butterflies, their populations are heavily depressed and declining, or the bird species, or the phytoplankton is 40% reduced. These sorts of very large-scale things that to me, scream, time out, take a step back, big boy, let's see what you're doing. But our culture seems to be saying very clearly, we're not going to look at that right now. You have to be alone with that information. That's where this... I feel when you say something in the architecture that prevents the awakening, there's not a lot of support, I feel, in the culture in which I find myself for awakening.
Oh, surely. An iteration of that point I was trying to rather voluminously make a minute ago, which is I don't think that the culture is actually preventing anybody from awakening. I think the subtleties are such that it's simply unwise to awaken. There's no prevention. There's no coercion of that ilk, I don't think. I think rather there's a running commentary on what constitutes good and right and just and merciful and sane and getting your fair share and all of that and what constitutes rights and all of that. When you look at those item by item things, what you find is the case is made that inattention to the kind of detail you just described is well advised, you see, because attention to it mitigates against happiness, contentment, your capacity to be a good neighbor, your sense of well-being, to be able to sit there with your legs crossed looking out the window and not feel you have to do something, but there's nothing to do, etc. Mm-hmm. This is, it would almost appear to be diabolical in how subtle it is. You see? And I suppose maybe that's the running definition of diabolical, is that you look in vain for the darkness when you're already in a dark place. You see? So the darkness is in our eye. It's not in the way it is. So this awakening in the face of what you just described a minute ago is first and foremost a courageous proposition. Whether or not it's mandatory, I don't think it's too hard to argue that, but mandatory in and of itself doesn't have much compelling power to it. It's more should, it's more got to. And people, it seems to me in North America as a rule, have long since changed the channel from the got to channel. Or the should channel, from the parenting voice, from the deeply disapproving voice. I mean, the irony is they apparently refer to the era that you and I now are speaking in as the Anthropocene era, which, you know, bears sonically a resemblance to the word obscene. Certainly it does. But that means human-centered. Or you could say, to sound slightly more biblical, that everything around us is wrought now in our image. In our image. That is what we have accomplished. We've placed ourselves so ruthlessly at the center of things that you would think that the capacity to be human, to awaken to all this, to marshal our best efforts for the sake of no other reason than for our own sense of well-being would be an inevitable consequence of living in a world that's human centered. Well, you look around and you see basically the opposite response is in full effect. There's probably never been a lonelier time to be alive and to be human than in a human-centered world. And that loneliness might be the thing that whispers in the middle of the night, what's the point, and turns it into a rhetorical question to defeat every inquiry that you can manage.
All right, that rings true, and I think a lot of people listening to this, myself included, can certainly have a relationship with that idea of the loneliness of this. And so when you said it's perhaps unwise to wake up in this culture, the culture isn't preventing it, but this it being unwise, here's the first thing that I think pops up, and when I that's why I wanted to start with that original quote from yours about the grief-soaked proposition. It's possibly unwise to wake up to this because there's a lot of grief in this material, which is a normal human sort of a response in a culture that studiously avoids anything related to emotions, but grief in particular. You've said in the past, if I've got this right, grief is a skill. What did you mean by that?
Well, let me go back one sentence before, and your characterization of grief being in the realm of feelings, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to suggest otherwise. And to suggest that grief is avoided, I'd like to suggest otherwise to that one too. So there's a lot of, I mean, the self-help section of the bookstore might be the bookstore now, for all I know. I don't know, with a small business section in the back, maybe between those two things, that covers everything now. Uh-huh. And the biggest section in the self-help department has got to be right now today, this grief thing. It's astounding how sudden it's making a claim on the front page. But you think about the front page. If the front page is the first thing you read, it's the first thing to ebb away as you plow through the details, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Just literally in terms of thumbing through a paper. So it's as soon as you turn that front page, pretty much that's gone as something that has banner headlines and is pleading for your attention. That's exactly what's happening with grief. Right now, it's front page news, but by dint of being front page news, it is doomed to the budgie cage very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Just like all the talk about dying and all the euthanasia discussion and all of that, this is a kind of competence-addicted culture's way of neutralizing everything that seems to neutralize competence, is that it pretends to take it into consideration just long enough to reassure you that you've now done that too. See? So the party line on grief is that it's essentially some kind of combination of feelings that's temporary, that intrudes on the natural order of things long enough to get your attention. If things are going well, long enough to get your attention, but not much longer than that. And you seek out the right remedies, and you too shall be emerge on the other side of grief, somehow subtly, shaken, but not fundamentally stirred,
mm-hmm.
and to get on happily and blithely and more capably with your day than you were able to before. So you realize the whole operation is that even grief is being seconded now as a self-help project. Now, let me offer you an alternative way of understanding it. What if grief is not a feeling, but in some fashion or other, it's the end of feelings? And what if grief is not an intrusion into the natural order of things, but actually a deep recognition of the natural order of things? And what if grief is not temporary, but that once it deeply visits you, it informs you so irrevocably that it becomes part of your take on things, not what happened to your take on things, but actually it becomes a capacity and not something that disables you. That is my understanding of how it functions. It's principally an action, you see. And we are not on the receiving end of grief. We are on the practicing end of grief. That means it is something you grow some skillfulness not to cope with and endure until it passes, any more than any other skillfulness is something you endure temporarily so you can get back to what? A less skillful proposition? I mean, it's in the nature of skill to hanker after it once you've had a taste for it. And grief is some kind of kinship to that kind of understanding. So grief, you know, you hear that the grief and loss industry is said as if it all were one word, as if grief and loss is this compound obligation you have to understand, that the hardest things are the ones that you lose. And, you know, dying would be a very good example of that. And if somebody close to you dies, and we use this as a synonym. Well, losing is what you do to something. It's not what something does to you, obviously. You lose your wallet, you've done that to the wallet, and you lose your father, and that's what you did to your father. And the language of loss sees to it that the capacity for grief does not happen, is not grown, because loss is deemed to be something that is inflicted upon you, that you're the victim of it. And I don't need to tell you or anybody who's listening how compelling victimology has become now. And it's one of the great, you know, get out of jail cards that this culture has produced, to the point now where, as James Hillman so gorgeously observed, there's no difference anymore between feeling abused and being abused. Apparently, they've become the same thing. So grief, in my understanding of it, in my practice of it, and in my observation of how scant and rare a proposition it actually is, is a very redemptive, not in the born-again sense of the term, but in the real sense of the term. The verb to redeem means to declare, to pursue in a disciplined way, and to declare a meaning heretofore gone into eclipse. You know, the verb to deem means to suggest or mean something. To redeem simply is to reconsider the meaning of something. It has nothing to do with the rapture and who gets in and who doesn't. That's not what it means. So they don't own the word. The redemption project, a phrase I'm fond of, is a project that is pleading for our humanity to appear and to work. And it seems to me that the clarion call of the redemption project in a time such as ours comes in the form of grief. That grief is the awakening that you were asking me about earlier. It's not the means of awakening, that once you've awakened, you don't need the grief anymore, like a takeout coffee cup. No, the grief is the awakening that you inadvertently were seeking, unbeknownst even to you.
So to redeem this word grief, if I can paraphrase what I've heard, is that instead of wading into the self-help section, finding something I can consume, and I'm going to experience grief so that, I can make it more intense, less intense, last longer, last shorter, learn something from it, operate my day better, in some way become more competent. Those are all very masculine approaches. I'm going to experience grief for a purpose. I'm hunting. I'm going to kill something with this. You're saying, if I've got this right, that grief is something we form a relationship with. Like we would form a relationship with a family member, not so that but because in relationship, things are unfold, things emerge through that. Is that fair?
Not, I wouldn't put it that way, only because to do so suggests that grief is a being somehow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would rather stand for the idea that let's use a very simple way of coming to it. Let's imagine that you enjoy tennis and that you play it. And I would ask you, well, why do you play it? And you say, well, it's because I enjoy it. And I would say to you, are you trying to get better at it? And you would probably say, well, of course. And I would say, why? Because it ups the enjoyment of it, of course. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's all quite well observed. And I would say to you, but you're not getting good at it so that you can finally stop playing, are you? Which is makes no sense whatsoever until you begin to recognize that a kind of skillfulness vis-a-vis grief, when I propose that, the hearing in the popular culture goes something like this. Oh, right. so you get good at grief, mm-hmm. so you can get on the other side of it, so you don't have to do it anymore. That's what getting good at grief is, even is having like a good relationship with this grief so that it won't bite you in the ass too badly, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that grief is in and of itself a skillfulness of being a human being. It's not something you have a relationship with. It is that which you, in a deeply disciplined way, you practice. You partly pursue. You partly seem pursued by it at times. Both of which has hopefully the purpose of a deep kind of introduction that you can not turn away from again, because it's made a claim upon you, in the, or it has the order of necessity about it, not the order of affliction. So it's not a matter of declawing and defanging grief until it sits quietly in your lap like a poodle.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. No. Grief is a human, scaled mystery. That's what it is. And I'm not sure if there is grief, quote, in the world that we partake of. It may be so, but this might be an interesting thing to consider. In medieval times, in Northern Europe in particular, in the monastic life, there are stations that you awaken through the course of the evening, deep into the night and into the early dawn, where you're at different layers of prayer and contemplation and so on. And I'm told that one of the contemplative exercises for those people in that time was to say in a kind of a chanting fashion, a Latin term, lacrimae rerum, which translates fairly readily for us as the tears that are in all things. And this is what they would say. They wouldn't say it in order to dry the tears that are in all things. They would say it so that it could be known, so that the deep facts of life that require endings in order for things to proceed, that visit human beings as an awareness of your end before your end actually comes. The possibility of you deepening your life as a direct consequence of realizing how fundamentally limited it is in time and in consequence and in import, all of those things inform your days. It's part of this wakefulness we were talking about earlier. And I don't know how grief can't be a consequence of this, including a wish that it was otherwise. Of course. Just like at the level of the turbulence and the torment that we've describing that's part of our corner of the world now, of course there is a wish that we had proceeded otherwise, but largely there's an enormous sense of kind of race-level guilt about the fact that we haven't done so. And so W.H. Auden said it so gorgeously and so remorselessly, it seems to me. He said, to paraphrase him, something in the order of, I am of a time where we would rather be defeated than be persuaded.
Hmm.
And once you, if you can pass through the self-hatred, the misanthropy that would seem to lead you towards, recognizing misanthropy as just our version of self-absorption, and come to the deep understanding that you imagine that we could have done it otherwise, but we didn't. Why not? There's something really wrong with us, or it would appear that we couldn't have done it otherwise, because we didn't, even though there were options galore of proceeding otherwise, but we didn't do so. So what's the angel, what's the midwife of proceeding otherwise? Awakening to the realization that heretofore you have not done so. If that ain't grief, I don't know what is. But that's the awakening I'm talking about.
Now, I want to, at this point, turn. I think it's appropriate here because that's so beautifully said in the connection here. I think you're informed, if I could be so bold, by all of the time you've spent in assisting those who are going through the process of death and dying.
It does have its effect, yeah.
Yeah, I bet it did. So to begin that, what is our cultural death phobia?
What is it?
Yeah, you've
Well,
described.
you've kind of said it in the question. You've characterized it quite well. I could say that there are, let's imagine that there are iterations of it that don't appear phobic in the least. Let's take, for example, be all you can be. That's a good one.
Yeah.
It's a kind of mania, but it's never presented to kids as mania. But my God, it's the most intolerant mania you could possibly imagine. Be all you could be. But where's this could live? Where's this thing called my potential? Where am I to seek it out? Well, by definition, it's in the future. And when does the future happen? And the answer is, it doesn't. It doesn't. The future is forever the not yet, the not realized, the not appeared, and the rest, you see? So the whole idea of holding, young people in particular to this kind of Iron Maiden torture called your potential, as if the person who's talking it can see it, and the young person has no clue, and the older person is holding them to this kind of standard. The whole thing reeks of a degree of intolerance for anything that constitutes ordinary, average, typical, and the rest. So the only iteration of yourself that's allowed is the superhero version of it. And that's what's buried in, quote, death phobia. Death phobia sounds like a well-informed aversion to limits. And fundamentally, leaving out the well-informed part, that's what death phobia is. It's an aversion to limit. And you see why, from that characterization, being able to talk about death phobia in those terms leads you so readily to a consideration of, quote, what we've done with this corner of the world that was entrusted to us. Because the language is virtually identical. We are limit phobic in the extreme. We are growth addicted. We're competence addicted, you see. And the intolerance that's in there would appear to be life affirming only if you understand the life as being the stage wherein all your genius gets to come out to play. But and I know that's not what life is, a staging area for your genius. What life is a oftentimes tormenting, broken place where, as my countryman who's recently died said, a crack where the light gets in. See? And that's it. So, to be deeply intolerant of limits essentially dooms you to a project of unrestrained, unfettered, and untethered growth. And if I may take one more iteration of that and push it a little bit, and it's not a concept, what I'm about to say, it's observable. I worked for years in the realm of oncology, and so tumors were a daily fare. And let me suggest to everyone listening now that a tumor is best understood as growth for its own sake. That's what a tumor is. A tumor is unrestrainedly leaning forward. That's what it does. It simply continues and it increases. So its rate of growth, I mean, you could invoke all kinds of economic language here and it wouldn't be out of place. The rate of growth, when it slows, is good news for the patient, but not good news for the tumor. You see, so the tumor's job is to continue regardless of the consequence to its host. Sound familiar? Yeah, it's disastrously familiar. So apparently Mars is plan B now. And it's interesting that all the dot-com money is going towards ending disease, ending death, and getting to Mars. It's quite astounding that that's where this new money is going. And of course, all these guys, these millionaires, sound philanthropic. And the word philanthropic means human loving. Well, maybe human-centered is a better rendering of those projects. I mean, if we're not supposed to die, what the hell are we supposed to be doing? What is our death? Is our death really an insult that enough dot-com money can finally put us on the right side of? I mean, how is that not the mania for growth iterated in another direction? And of course, the consequence of tumors is, by virtue of it growing untethered to the consequence of its growth, it literally kills what sustains it. That's its job description, to kill what sustains it, but at least to grow. And then you think of that language in terms of the personal growth industry by which North America is so easily recognizable in the rest of the world. And you realize, my God, it's the same language again. And it is. And it's the same mania again. And it's the same intolerance again. And it's the same blindness and the deep unwillingness to be a human being and to be reined in by grief. Not to be restrained, but to be bound to what sustains you. That's not defeat. Unless your project is to be unrestrained, then it is. But if your project is to live a mutually nourishing life, then to be restrained in that regard is to be disciplined so that your capacities serve something. And in so doing, you recognize how much on the receiving end of being served you have been, which is, of course, what our childhood is for. And the ending of our childhood is often accomplished by recognizing how deeply on the take we have been without ever recognizing it. And sometimes you get to live long enough where you can go, we can turn to your parent and you can say, I'm sorry, I had no idea for the longest time. And of course, your parent would probably say, yeah, I know. And there it is, you know, at the level of family. Well, what kind of, I don't want to say cosmic parent, what kind of planetary being can we turn to now and say, I'm sorry, I had no idea?
So I'm wondering if perhaps some of the energy for that self-help industry is not contained within the rather meaninglessness that many people find themselves locked into. And so you're speaking to this idea that there's a deeper meaning, and that grief can help us get closer to that, death can help us get closer to that, that there is a call to greatness that exists within these things that might be termed things you would rather avoid or find averse in our culture, although people are starting to turn towards them. But to get to the heart of this, you had a really important piece for me, one of the many downloads, transmissions, whatever you call them, that I took from the Roe weekend was this. When you say we're spending all this money to try to go to Mars, the tyranny of hope is what pops in. And I would love for you to explain that to people right now, what you mean by the tyranny of hope.
The tyranny of hope. The tyrant hope, yeah. Well, okay. Thank you for asking. Hope has got a very, very elaborate PR firm working for it. You know, especially in a grim time such as we agree that we're in, then hope actually doubles down, and then you're obliged to be hopeful now as a kind of primary obligation to be able to go to any other form of action, or you have to be hopeful. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's wonder about what being hopeful actually does to you. Not the content, not the hoped for thing, but what's the consequence of enacting this generic hopefulness that we're, you know, awash in at almost a terminal degree? Well, a parallel might be helpful. And if it's it's an economically astute audience that we're speaking to, this will not be lost on anyone listening. There's a thing called a mortgage. And of course, the word mortgage, you know, the first part of it is the word death. And the second part of it is the word to portion out or gradient of. So a mortgage very clearly is like death on the installment plan. That's what the word actually means. But let's go to the consequences of being ensnared in a mortgage. The principal consequence is that you are obliged to set aside things that you would do now, money you would spend now, because you're in debt, and in hopes that, or with the assurance that if you are willing to forego enough for long enough, you will come into the full ownership, outright ownership of that which you have been mortgaged in the name of. That's essentially how it functions. In other words, it is the function, it's the consequence of being mortgaged to become hostile in principle to deeply occupying the present moment. Even the present moment itself is mortgaged for the sake of some possible future, some reassured or guaranteed future, economically speaking. So if you take the understanding of this from mortgage and consider hope, you realize, my God, item by item, it functions the same way. And the best way I've tried to give people a feel for this when they're sitting across from me, as I say, are you sitting there now, hopeful that you're sitting there now? And people look at you like, this is just simply make no sense at all. And at some level, they're right. But it's a kind of nonsense that's a mandatory realization. Hope, by its definition, happens to you in the present, but it turns you away from the present for the sake of the hoped for something, which is always, always in the future. So when I was working with people who were dying for so many years, and they were obliged as a kind of moral obligation, really, to engage this hope project along with their lunatic cheerleaders, which you would know as family and close friends, and all together now, this doesn't have to go like this. All together now, we can think good thoughts, eat enough broccoli, you know, and all the rest, because there's nothing, there's no givenness to the ending of your life. That's what hope is for, is to crucify endings, you see, and make them pay, and make them suffer, and make them leave you alone. And anybody thinks I'm overstating this, they haven't thought about it enough. They haven't been around to see what being hopeful actually does to people who are dying anyway, you see. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible affliction, and it means nobody no good, and the outcomes are this kind of compound loneliness where the allegation that hope is life-affirming, when you think about it for 5 seconds, you realize the only portion of life that hope affirms is the endless, limitless potential life. Well, please, somebody tell me where that life is, the limitless, the potential. Where is it? Well, we've been sucking on the tit of that for quite a while now in the West, and the world is shriveling as a consequence. There's no such thing as limitless, even in hopefulness. And sadly, some people have to come to the utter bankruptcy of hope as a prerequisite for being able to begin to practice the grief that I was talking about earlier.
And the one turn of that phrase that I loved is that you're not preaching that people should be hopeless, but to be hope-free.
Hope-free.
Hope-free. Exactly. I like that.
Hope-free. Yeah, it's you don't have to go back and forth between the two terminal propositions. You know, hopeful. Oh, so you're hopeless. Well, I used to be hopeless. Oh, so you're hopeful. No, better. What's better than hopeful? Well, you know, I'm not trafficking in two versions of the same thing, which is what hopeless and hopeful are. They're two brands of cola on the same shelf at Walmart. That's what they are. And they change nothing, no matter which one you're afflicted by. Hope-free, on the other hand, suggests something like this. You have been afflicted by hopefulness, and you've experimented with hopelessness just as resolutely, and something happened whereby you lost them both, and you're no longer capable of practicing either. So I don't want to make it sound like it's some kind of, you know, elevated status at all. I'm simply suggesting that if your hopefulness and your hopelessness are properly exhausted, your capacity to be hope-free can now appear, where simply means that you don't require hope to proceed. That's all it means. And in the face of what's coming, what may have already begun to come, in the face of that, awakened people need to be able to proceed without hope, without an insistence that they need an assurance that whatever they try to do will pan out in the long term. And without that assurance, you can't count on them. That's the affliction I see around me. Don't ask me if you can't reassure me that what I'm prepared to work towards could come to pass. I'm saying, as one grown up to another in a troubled time, you have an obligation to be able to proceed minus any assurance that anything good will come from it. And if you don't have that capacity, you're still 7 years old, man, and you still want the payday before the work goes in.
And this is where you use the word courageous. To me, that is the definition of courageous, which is I'm willing to proceed even though I have no idea or any assurance of the outcome in this. And
I think it's a little more afflicted than that characterization. It could be something closer to this. Samuel Beckett, great Irish writer. He has a book title, and the book title says what you and I are talking about right now. The name of the book is I Can't Go On, I'll Go On. Now, if you don't pay attention to how he's phrased it, you think what he's saying is, I can't go on, I can go on. But he doesn't say that. See, that's hopeful and hopeless again.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I can't go on, I'll go on. And, you know, at the risk of cheapening an elaborate and well-accomplished book just by making a phrase of the title, I believe his title says this. I have an obligation in a troubled time to go on not being able to. And if you let that stand and you don't try to resolve that, and you recognize the inability to go on is no more predicting of the outcome than the ability to go on is. Neither one of these foreclose on what may yet come to pass. However, the depths of the trouble mean that there is such a thing as not being able to go on. And you turn away from that at your peril. The recognition that you cannot go on is a real time in people's lives. It's not a failure, moral or otherwise. It's not a collapse. It's a true thing. And it takes courage to know that you're in a time when you cannot go on. And what Beckett is saying is, there come times in our lives when we go on not being able to, where you're not obliged to choose between those two realities, that both of them are your companions now. And I think the degree of trouble that we are seeing beginning to crest now requires both of those skills, the skill of not being able to go on and the skill of doing so at the same time and not being obliged to choose between them and pretending that because you've read or watched Bucket List enough times, you know how to get on the other side of being defeated. There is nothing on the other side of being defeated. When you lose, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have done to that which has sustained us, we've done it long enough now that the losing has begun.
Mm-hmm.
That's a non-negotiable situation. You can have as many politicians you want try to get your vote from you by claiming they're going to make something great again. But there is no again to go back to, you see.
Mm-hmm.
That's what grown-ups know about a troubled time. And there is a degree of courage in that, absolutely. But it's a courage that has no promise in it. That if you're courageous, secretly, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah.
No, this kind of courage is being able to proceed knowing that it's not going to be okay anytime soon.
Mm. Absolutely. That's so beautifully said. And, you know, in preparing for this, I we're right at the heart of this now. I came across a recorded speech you gave, and this one line really jumped out at me out of an hour. And you said, if you want to change something, then your lens and your thrust has to be at the level of culture, not at the level of individual psyche. And I know many of my fellow members here at Peak Prosperity very much want to change things. But this idea of changing something at the cultural level may strike some of us, it does me, as both reasonable and terribly difficult, or at least a generationally slow project where we might not hold the view that we have that sort of time. So in your direct experience, how can culture be consciously amended, appended, or dare we say changed?
Mm-hmm. Yes, another well-wrought and very disturbing question. Well, let's start a slightly earlier than when you asked it. And let's ask whether or not you can change your mind. Now, you know, all the self-help brigade clings to this as the latest, greatest hope that anybody possibly has. Like, until I can change me, you know, we could go on for 15 minutes with these kind of aphorisms. Mm-hmm. An unchanged me will just result in the same. I got to change me, work on me, you know, and all of that. Well, here's the question. And I'm not saying this as a Rubik's Cube foolishness. I mean, really, if you're going to change your mind, where is this mind that you propose to change? What is your relationship to this mind? What part of you is not the part that needs changing when you think about changing your mind? Who's doing the changing while your mind gets changed? Who's in charge of dictating what the nature of the change should be? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
There's no part of you that is unafflicted by that which you propose to change, including your understanding of what needs changing. Mm. Now, that's very confounding when you let that in. This, another way of saying this is the solution-generating industry is the same industry that generated the dilemma that it's now proposing to fix.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So an understanding that is addicted to fixing, but completely unwilling to be aggrieved by that which needs the attention and the fixing, is a place that is simply selling, as you know, that great song by The Who in 1970s, meet the new boss. Same as the old boss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's coming, and that's what all the solutions are. So the real question to my mind is not how do you change culture, but how is culture made? If you would imagine that it's not naturally occurring, mm-hmm. like the clouds outside my window right now, it's not naturally occurring. It's a consequence of an X number of humans, I don't know the magic number, proceeding in a certain fashion, yes. But how? If we could reserve the word culture for some kind of human-scaled mystery, which is an accomplished thing, not an inevitable thing, then we can ask the question, well, then how do these humans make culture? And I submit to you it happens something like this. Culture is made by enough people being willing to proceed, mindful to the point of defeat, about what the consequence of enough of them being together in one place has become. That's what culture is. Doesn't sound like any kind of accomplishment at all. I know.
Mm.
I know it doesn't. I know it's a hard sell to imagine that the principal attribute of culture is the willingness to recognize the immense consequence that we have on the place that we settle in while we're trying to be cultured. So, real culture, seems to me, is an achievement that is a consequence of a willingness to know the deep expense or consequence we exact on the place that we propose to be nourished by. And to do that, you have to have a deep understanding and a willingness to know that all of this nourishment, all of the sustenance is fundamentally limited in scope and scale and consequence and nourishment and time, that it's not bottomless. I mean, I don't know how old you are, but you certainly are aware that there was a time when everybody knew there was enough oil. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not saying it was true. I'm simply saying everybody knew it Well, how could you tell? Because of the way everybody proceeded, that's how you could tell. All the decisions that were made, all the buying decisions that were made, all the city planning decisions that were made, were all predicated on the idea that there'd be enough oil, and then enough cheap oil, and all the permutations. And of course, this is demonstrably false. But that didn't prevent many of us from, quote, knowing it and proceeding accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then up until recently, there was enough water, wasn't there? Now, man, what does it even mean? Okay, where does this understanding come from that what sustains us most deeply has no bottom? Because that's the prejudice. And I suggest to you, it comes from monotheism. That everywhere the world has endured monotheism, it has endured this idea that it is in the nature of the divine, to be unlimited and bottomless and infinitely capacitated. See?
Mm-hmm.
And if we could rehabilitate our understanding of what constitutes divine to include in our understanding of divinity limit, then the cultural change that you're talking about, I think, has the possibility to ensue. But until our take on the fundaments of life include limitation, especially the ephemeral or the spiritual or the divine understandings that we might have, until that change occurs, I don't see any possibility for a culture willfully, purposefully changing itself before it's destroyed, before it goes down the pipe howling. I don't see it. I don't see it because, you know, the fundamental misapprehension of what sustains it is whispering, there's always more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I said that thing about, and we don't have to die, and we don't have to be sick, and we can get to Mars. That's absolutely an unrepentant idea, and it will not give way, as you can plainly see. And enough R&D money, and we can do that too. But we're in the land that was built by R&D money. We're in a time that's a consequence of big budgets for these things. And this is what we have. Who's doing the math? See, it seems to me it's kind of obvious. You know, how's it working so far to be all we can be? And of course, the apologists say, well, we're not all we could be. Well, why not? Well, we haven't spent enough R&D dollars. Here we go again. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So let's imagine that we're at the very limit of self-improvement, and that the limit of self-improvement looks like the world that we're about to bequeath to people that are being born this week. Let's imagine that. Let's imagine that that's the very antithesis of deep human culture. The real human culture is lived understanding that your obligation is fundamentally not only to the human unborn or not yet born, but to all the manner of life forms not yet, you know, not yet with us, and that we proceed as if they will be.
Hmm.
That would be something.
That would be
so. All of these fundamental disturbances seem to be, to me, to be mandatory before change of the kind of the magnitude that you, that your question suggested, is even imaginable, never mind pursuable, I think. Of course, if you're willing to rethink your take on the divine in this fashion, then the change you're asking me about is probably already underway. So it's not even a staged out or sequenced proposition. It's a kind of alchemical or mycelial moment where one thing changes and by some mystery that I don't pretend to understand, 18,000 changes ensue almost immediately from something like that being entertained. Now, courage again, isn't it? But a foolish, a wily kind of courage that has cunning in it is really what we're talking about here, not like onward Christian soldier stuff. I'm talking about a courage that's deeply informed. You know, my countryman, again, he got a gorgeous line in one of his songs. He says, he said, you know, you loved me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline. How many nights I've prayed for this to let my work begin. First we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin. That's not a bad recipe and not a bad understanding, that your adversaries require discipline to contend with you once you have begun to cultivate this grief-nourished understanding of what's being asked of you. And generally speaking, adversaries to a deeply soulful existence don't have discipline. They have fear, they might have power, but they don't have discipline. And minus discipline, they will do what they've done 1,000 times before. But if the deal shifts, and if your capacity, if your willingness to proceed otherwise shifts, then their habituated understanding simply can't contend. And you could say that human freedom, fundamental human freedom, is the capacity to respond differently to an unchanged something. And that's what I'm advocating, I guess.
Oh, that's so beautifully said. And it in the final quote of yours I had prepared here, I think maybe you've just answered it, because the question was around this quote of yours where you said, "Our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure."
Yeah, truly. Huh? You can learn this from being a parent. You can learn it. Doesn't mean you will. But one of the most unnerving things you can do to your child is to continually remind them that they are the center of your household and that their emotional disposition governs the day and the rest. Kids, when they have a sense of their consequence or their power of that magnitude, they can go out of their minds with that stuff. And it seems to me, you know, the human-centered understanding of things has driven many of us to the very brink of sanity while proposing to ennoble us and to grant us our sanity. I mean, who among us wants to have that much consequence in the world? I mean, even the most pompous and bombastic and running for office types, you know, when they actually win, they'll blink in the camera and you can hear it. God, what have I done? Or you can see it in their eyes. I mean, they love the contention of running for office, but the idea of actually being there and not just fighting completely unnerves them. What human wants to have that much consequence in the world? Really. So a little local life lived as if what we've been talking about is true, informed by the understanding that the ripples of your days are not for you to decide their meaning. They're for you to labor in the presence of the meaning of other people, the ones who came before you, and understanding all the while that the meaning of your life is in the hands of those to come, that you don't have an authoritative voice in the meaning of your life. You don't, and it's proper that you don't. And there's humility, yes, but there's no humiliation in that. The humiliation comes in when you try to compensate for feeling impotent by overstating your consequence, overstating how important you are in the scheme of things. It's your humanity, baby. It's not you. It's your humanity that the world needs. It's not you. You're free to be your small self. Let the world be fed by your humanity. Not a bad deal for all concerned.
That's absolutely perfect. I got everything that I ever hoped for out of this interview and more, and I could keep talking, but in honor of your time and respect for your time, I'm going to call it here, and I want to first thank you for your work in the world. I'm acutely aware that to be a truth teller is sometimes a lonely place to be, sometimes a hostile place to be, depending on how
I've
you receive
that.
It.
I've heard that, yeah.
And your work is just beautiful. It's just brilliant. And if we could, I have many, many more things to ask you at some point, if you're open to that, and may go request later if that seems appropriate. But for now, I would love to let people know more about your work, how they can follow you. I know we've got a lot of people interested in who you are. We're going to link to your books. And of course, you have a website as well. And I wonder if you would be willing to tell us a bit about your school.
Sure, happily. First of all, I hope nobody's interested in who I am, because it's not a big deal. You know, apropos of what I was just saying, maybe there's some usefulness in some of the things I'm, you know, trying to contend with kind of vocally, but not me. I'm just a little example. So just we put the emphasis on the right syllable there, hopefully. Yeah, thank you for asking about the school. I was lucky enough to be prompted by the ludicrous idea that people would be willing to be troubled in a similar fashion to the way I was, and that they would actually pay for the privilege. And that's exactly what's happened since 2010, I guess it was, to the point where we just opened a new class at the school, and it was filled in 3-4 days again, and this happens now virtually every time. And I think it's an indication, not, quote, that I'm doing anything right at all, much more so that there seems to be a quietly increasing willingness to be drawn in to the deep concernedness of that these things ask of us, not to bank on reassurance and, you know, the 12 steps, the 5 stages, all the solution mania, but actually to linger for much longer than sanity would seem to dictate with those things that trouble and sorrow and harrow, because all of these have their sustenance. And anyway, so we do the school. It's a couple of times a year for each class over a 2-year period. And it's a proper school. There's inquiry, there's study, there's the discipline that I was mentioning earlier. There's a reading list and all the rest. And it's a thrill, and it's an enormous privilege that people are willing to do this and come, you know, and sit down alongside me and with each other. And I would never have imagined it, as I said to my wife in those days. I said to her, but nobody would come, because who's dreaming such a dream? I said, thinking it was a rhetorical way of contending with her suggestion. And lo and behold, I was wrong again. And these ways I have of being wrong on occasion have turned into some pretty good arrangements, and that's one of them. So the Orphan Wisdom School is what it's called, and anybody's interested in learning about it, just Orphan Wisdom, just like it sounds, allonewordcom, and there's a brief but to the point description of the enterprise there, and some other things that you've been kind to mention are there too.
As well as other events that you have going on, and if, I would encourage anybody, if you do have the chance to attend Orphan Wisdom School, I haven't, but having met people who have gone, and also having interacted with Stephen as briefly as I have, I would highly recommend that, or seeing him if you have the chance, well worth your time. As well, the movie Griefwalker and his other books, which we're going to be listing at the bottom of this. Stephen, thank you for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today.
Well, you know, please understand it as a privilege that I have to be spoken to as if, you know, what I've been wrestling with for years might have some use to somebody somewhere down the line, because that's the greatest acknowledgement, the greatest gift, and I'm on the receiving end of that over this last hour, and my appreciation goes back to you for that too.
I thank you for that.